ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The tariffs are going forward on time, on schedule.
Americans are worried that President Trump's plan to tax imports could make inflation worse and consumer confidence is dropping.
Today is Tuesday, February 25th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, the White House announces new rules for the press corps that covers the president.
Also, we'll head out with a team in Syria working to clear unexploded bombs.
So this is a wide open field. Grapevines are planted here, olive trees, and the white helmets are going in now looking for munitions.
Later in Kansas, one man is fighting in the state legislature for the right to keep raccoons as pets.
And the party's over for Party City.
The first and only place we shopped was Party City. That's where you went.
Plus, this week's unsung hero involves strangers on a plane.
Now the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. House Republicans have approved the framework of a partisan plan key to President Trump's domestic agenda. NPR's Claudio Grisales reports the legislation passed by just two votes after weeks of tense party negotiations.
The budget framework unlocks the next steps for Republican-led committees to piece together the details for the sweeping multi-trillion dollar plan. The partisan plan will address immigration, tax, defense, and energy policy, as well as extend $4.5 trillion in tax cuts passed under President Trump's first term. It also aims to cut $2 trillion in federal spending, which could lead to more than $800 billion in cuts to major U.S. health programs such as Medicaid. The lone Republican to vote no on the plan, Kentucky's Thomas Massie, argued the GOP effort will add $20 trillion to the U.S. debt. While the framework's passage marks a huge victory for Trump and House Republicans, they still have a very long way to go. Claudia Grisales, NPR News.
A federal judge is ordering the Trump administration to pay hundreds of millions of dollars by midnight Wednesday to fund U.S. AID projects across the globe. NPR's Frank Langford has more from Washington.
D.C. federal judge Amir Ali has repeatedly ordered Trump officials to reopen the flow of funding to thousands of aid projects. But at his latest hearing, Ali said the Trump administration has provided no evidence it's done so. The judge also complained that he could not get a straight answer from the administration as to why. The government claims it has the right to withhold funds as it reviews grants and contracts. The judge has already determined that the funding cutoff is doing irreparable harm to the organizations, which have had to lay off staff and halt operations. So far, the judge has declined a plaintiff's motion to fine the government in contempt of court. Frank Langford, NPR News, Washington.
A new study finds cancer death rates among black Americans have declined over the past 30 years. However, the numbers are more complicated than they seem. Scott Marcioni from member station WYPR reports.
The study from the American Cancer Society found that cancer death rates for black men fell nearly 50% since 1991. For black women, the rate dropped 33%. The study credits a decrease in smoking for the improvement, as well as better cancer treatment and screening methods. Still, black Americans continue to have higher cancer mortality rates than their white counterparts. The disparities stem from inequalities in health that trace back to structural racism, according to the authors of the study. Those disparities include differences in medical access, socioeconomic status, and insurance coverage. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni in Baltimore.
The broad market fell further from recent record run-ups amid heightened concerns about the confidence of U.S. consumers. The S&P 500 was down 28 points. The NASDAQ fell 260 points today. You're listening to NPR. The good news is NASA and the European Space Agency are giving Earth the all clear in terms of a newly discovered asteroid. They say after 2 months of observation, scientists have almost entirely ruled out any threat. The football field-sized object will strike Earth. At one point, the odds of a strike in 2032 were as high as 3%, but have now fallen to a fraction of that. However, they are not entirely ruling out the asteroid hitting the moon. They say there's still a 1.7% chance that could happen. The all-time leading scorer in the history of the WNBA, Dinah Taurasi, the longtime Phoenix Mercury star who led Team USA to six Olympic gold medals, says it is time for the next chapter. NPR's Becky Sullivan has more.
Three-time WNBA champion, six-time Olympic gold medalist, three national titles with her college team, Connecticut. It was quite a career for Diana Taurasi, who's 42 now. She told Time magazine she made the decision to retire last month, but it was on her mind before then, evident as she spoke to fans after the final Mercury home game of last season.
And if it is the last time...
She paused, smiled, thanked her fellow players.
If it is the last time, it felt like the first time. I love you guys.
Taurasi leaves a healthier WNBA than when she began. Ratings and attendance were up big last year, and three new teams are set to join the league over this year and next. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Concerns about the effects of proposed Trump administration tariffs weighed on oil prices today. Oil down 2.5%. Crude oil futures settled at $68.93 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Americans' concern about high prices helped put Donald Trump back in the White House. But a month into Trump's second term as president, some people are worried that his policies could make inflation worse. Those worries contributed to a sharp drop in consumer confidence this month. NPR's Scott Horsley is here to explain it. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Ari.
So this confidence measure is from an economic think tank called the Conference Board. What do the numbers show?
They show that people are less confident in the economy now than they were a month ago. In fact, February saw the steepest one-month slide in confidence in 3.5 years. We saw a similar warning signal from a separate survey from the University of Michigan that came out last week. You know, people are worried that inflation is going to get worse rather than better in the coming months, which is partly a reaction to what they're seeing at the supermarket or when they go out to eat. You know, egg prices continue to soar as a result of avian flu. Denny's just joined Waffle House in adding an egg surcharge to their menu prices. But people are also worried about President Trump's threats to impose steep taxes on imports. The Conference Board, Stephanie Guichard, says tariffs and trade policy came up again and again as a concern in this month's survey.
Consumers have been reading a lot about it. I mean, you can't open the news without reading something about how tariffs are going to impact inflation.
On this program last night, for example, we heard NPR's Joe Hernandez talking about how the president's threat to tax imported steel and aluminum could raise the price of canned soup or craft beer. Now the administration's exploring tariffs on copper as well. So people are paying attention to the possible price impact of that, and it's rattling their confidence.
Is that causing the president to reconsider at all? Is Trump backing away from any of his tariff threats?
Not yet, at least not rhetorically. Trump was asked this week about his threat to impose a 25% tax on all imports from Canada and Mexico, two of the country's biggest trading partners. Earlier this month, you might remember, he hit the pause button on those tariffs in exchange for some border security measures. But now Trump is suggesting that was just a temporary reprieve, which means we could be looking at higher prices for tomatoes from down south or 2x4s from up north.
The tariffs are going forward on time, on schedule.
We'll see now if the president actually follows through on that next week or if this is just more posturing. If he does levy tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico, those countries have promised to retaliate with tariffs of their own on U.S. exports.
When you look at this report, what does it say about who is most nervous about the economy right now?
In the Conference Board survey, the drop in confidence was pretty widespread. It cuts across all different ages and income groups. The University of Michigan survey does offer a partisan breakdown as well, and it showed, not surprisingly, that Republicans are still pretty bullish about the economy, but Democrats and significantly independents are feeling more pessimistic about where the economy's headed.
And how does that affect people's spending?
Yeah, that's the big question, because what we've seen in the past several years is that even when people say they're feeling gloomy, they continue to spend money on things like travel and entertainment, and that keeps the economy humming. So long as the job market holds up and people keep getting paychecks, that's probably going to continue. But if it doesn't, then you're not just talking about a drop in confidence, you're talking about a real potential slowdown in economic activity. Many of the people who answered the conference board survey this month said they plan to spend less on big ticket items like cars and TVs in the months to come, maybe take fewer vacations. But as with Trump's tariff threats, we'll have to wait and see if they actually follow through on that.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thanks.
You're welcome.
During a brutal 14-year civil war, the regime controlling Syria dropped hundreds of thousands of bombs and other munitions on its own civilians. Now, Syria's new government must clear the unexploded leftovers. NPR's Emily Fang and Jawad Rizala spent a day with a team doing just that.
Syria is covered with unexploded bombs. Some of them are mines, buried underground, waiting for some unlucky passerby. In the village of Kirbat Nafal, they fell from the sky. Local resident Tamer Faisal Mohamed heard the planes come on December 6th, 2 days before Syria's regime fell. He says regime allied forces were trying to strike military depots nearby in a last-ditch attempt to halt a rebel advance. And on the main road leading into his village, planes dropped cluster munitions. Bombs that split into dozens of smaller explosive munitions when they hit the ground. By some estimates, the Assad regime dropped up to 1 million munitions over Syria, and many of them remain in the ground. Mohamed says sometimes they blow up cows, sometimes children. The United Nations says there have been more than 400,000 incidents in Syria, often fatal, with unexploded bombs in the last 9 years alone. But today, Mohamed says this is the first time someone has come to clear the bombs. Clearing them up are Syrian civil defense workers, mostly from the White Helmets, a rescue organization based in Syria. The team we're following today is led by this man, Hassan Tulfa. He's a burly, bearded man who projects a supernatural calm. He's been doing this work since 2014. Just months after starting, he says he accidentally stepped backwards, right onto an unexploded munition. It blew off his left leg below the knee. Chulfa says he contemplated giving up his work. All he wanted was to be able to walk again. And he did. He wears a prosthetic now, and he went back to disposing of bombs and missiles. There's just too much need for people like him, he says. And that's why he's now here, hands on hips, the picture of concentration, surveying his men looking for cluster bombs.
So this is a wide open field. Grapevines are planted here, olive trees. And the White Helmets are going in now with these bright yellow sensors looking for munitions.
They walk deliberately in tandem, step by step,
carefully poking at the shrubbery.
The day before, Tulfa says they found 12 cluster munitions here, and they've only checked half the field. Passerby shout encouragement as the men work. One of them is Samira Haddad, taking a stroll with her husband. She does a double take when we tell her bombs were found just steps from where she's standing. She says she takes this road every day to buy bread. Then a call goes up from Tulfa's men.
They found something?
It's a type of cluster bomb. Tulfa's cleared enough munitions to know this particular bomb will need 24 sandbags filled with earth set around the bomb to safely contain a controlled explosion. The other day, his men had to fill 265 sandbags to safely clear a missile that had landed in front of a hospital. It's back-breaking work. And when the moment of detonation arrives, Tulfa's supernatural calm breaks, ever so briefly. He says this is the only moment when he tenses up. There is zero room for error. Tulfa double-checks that everyone has moved back and instructs me to take cover behind a cement wall before ordering the detonation. Success. By now, we've spent hours in the bright sun. all for just one cluster munition in one field outside one village. Tulfa personally has dozens of more reports of other munitions from other residents that he has yet to attend to. Tulfa says he thinks it will take more than 100 years to remove all the unexploded ordinances in Syria. They'll be back again tomorrow and the day after that. Dropping the munitions took just a few seconds, but it will mean a lifetime of work for these men. Emily Fang, NPR News, Homs, Syria.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast, stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression. Today's story comes from Caitlin Shetterly. In March 2014, she boarded a flight home to Maine from the West Coast and started chatting with a man sitting next to her. She told him that she'd been nervous to fly ever since the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
I said something to him about, you know, do you ever get worried? He said, you know, no. And he looked at me full in the face with complete compassion and closeness, as if we had known each other for a very long time, and looked right into my eyes and said, most people are good. It just like reset something, almost like a light switch in my body. It was so powerful to me. And I came home and I remember telling my husband about it. And seriously, since then, we have used that line to completely reshape how we teach our sons to think about the world and think about strangers and think about courage. A year and a few months ago, when the shooting happened here in Maine, in Lewiston, I overheard my husband in my younger son's bedroom saying to him quietly, most people are good. Those four words have totally transformed us and how we react to tragedy and how we react to so many things happening in the world. I've said it on car rides to friends' kids. I've said it to other friends. I just say it as a casual thing with no, like, you know, Steven Spielberg kind of music overlay. But I just hope someday that people remember me saying that too, and I feel like I'm trying to pay it forward, and I hope it keeps going forward.
Caitlin Shetterly lives in Maine. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, whose scientists work to lay the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, which are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Between the vampire teeth, the giant balloons, the streamers, and the glittery napkins, one store laid claim to celebrations across America, Party City. Well, that juggernaut is now bankrupt, turning off the music and shutting it all down. NPR's Alina Selyukh has this remembrance.
What came first, America's obsession with Halloween or Party City?
Party City Halloween.
After my first year in the business, I said, wow.
That's Steve Mandel, who in 1986 launched Party City with a single store in New Jersey.
I never expected Halloween to be anything like it.
And his original idea was to focus on party supplies, a one-stop shop for birthday or holiday get-togethers.
Napkins and cups and plates.
But that first year, he realized costumes were the gold mine.
We actually enlarged our original store to really accommodate Halloween the right way the second year.
Soon there were more stores, a franchise. By the time Mandel left in 1999, Party City was a national chain. This was the era of category killers, one megastore dominating some facet of shopping, the heyday of Toys R Us and Barnes & Noble, and for parties, Party City.
The first and only place we shopped was Party City. That's where you went.
Teresa Peverly, then on a college student budget, outfitted her entire backyard wedding reception at Party City, buying so much ribbon to tie up her silverware and napkins.
I got a little excited because I think I bought 9 or 10 spools. 26 years later, we still have some of these spools of ribbons, and we have tied them for baby presents and graduations, and it just makes me laugh and think fondly about Party City when I have to get more ribbon out.
When you ask people for memories of Party City, shoppers recall meaningful milestones. A retirement, a sorority reunion, their mom's last day of chemotherapy, their son's fourth birthday in a pandemic lockdown. One woman thinks back to the shortage of miniature flags after the September 11 attacks. A teacher describes a giant balloon arch she'd bought for a school event. At Party City in Maryland, cashier Christina Marin remembers the first time someone gave her sealed results of an ultrasound scan.
I was the first person to know, like, the gender. It was really special.
They wanted a gender reveal balloon.
I was nervous because the balloons, they get really big and sometimes they pop and I didn't want it to pop and all the confetti.
In fact, if you ask workers for Party City memories, balloons float to the top.
Everyone on Saturdays and Sundays is on balloon duty, tie balloons pretty much all day long.
Jonathan D'Arcangelo started as a stocker in the late 90s and left as a manager in 2003, having tied ribbons on thousands of balloons.
Sometimes I laugh. I think my fingers might have a permanent curve in it from doing all these balloons. Years later, I can still tie a balloon pretty fast, so I still have the technique down.
D'Arcangelo first got the job in high school. A lot of people did. Party City's teenage employees gave the stores a come-as-you-are vibe, with workers dressed in Halloween costumes, cracking up about ill-prepared shoppers, stuffing a dozen balloons into a two-door car.
They didn't realize, like, oh, well, I bought all these balloons, how am I going to get them home, you know?
The balloons and the wigs and the costumes, they're fun to buy in person, which shielded Party City from online competition for a long time. In 2012, the chain was bought by private equity and loaded with massive debt. This was manageable while sales grew until they didn't.
Unfortunately, with internet retail, there was no reason to go there except for balloons, and you can't make that much money on balloons, I guess.
In fact, a helium shortage made that business tricky. Meanwhile, shoppers defected to Spirit Halloween and Amazon and Walmart, even Home Depot with its giant skeletons. Then the pandemic killed parties, then high inflation, and Party City's debt haunted the chain to death.
I'm really going to miss this place. I'm very upset that it's closing, really upset.
Sherry Swartz found liquidation sales at her neighborhood Party City, shopping for her grandson's sixth birthday party the night before. Next time...
I guess I'm going to have to be more organized and do it off of Amazon, because now Amazon will own the world.
The aisles around her scream 20 to 75% off candy and placemats and Easter baskets. One shopper tells me the prices still seem too high, though she might return at the last second, she says, to see if the discounts get bigger. Alina Seluch, NPR News.
In Kansas, one man has been furiously lobbying his legislature to pass a bill into law. His cause could be described as an unusual pet peeve. Rose Conlin of member station KMUW explains.
In front of a panel of lawmakers in a Kansas legislative committee room, Stephen Casper rose to speak about a matter dear to his heart. For the past 4 years, he's been feeding and training raccoons in his neighborhood.
It is the highlight of my life. These are the things that you do when you become an empty nester. You start playing with raccoons in the backyard.
Having a pet raccoon is legal in at least a handful of states, but not Kansas. And with the help of a lawmaker who had a raccoon companion as a child, Casper is determined to change that.
It's like any other exotic breed. We have exotic cats that are legal, servals, Chelseas, parrots, ferrets, sugar gliders.
He's not talking about bringing wild raccoons inside, but his bill would allow people to buy domesticated raccoons from licensed breeders. They'd need to complete a course on raccoon care, keep their pets up to date on vaccines, and give them their own room or enclosure. But several veterinarians at the hearing, including some who are lawmakers, were not on board. They talked about risks with rabies and distemper. State Representative Dwayne Droege said he knows from personal experience that raccoons are unruly.
I had a roommate in veterinary school that had one that just took over the refrigerator. It would hide until you opened the refrigerator door and it'd take over the refrigerator and you couldn't even go in the kitchen.
After the hearing, I called Casper, who works in sales in the Kansas City area. He says raccoons are victims of misinformation.
They are extremely intelligent. They problem solve. They are phenomenal little creatures. But then there's the other part of it is, when you really get to know them, they are the most affectionate, goofy little things on the face of the earth.
He feeds them fruit and vegetables, and in videos online, marshmallows out of his hand.
Come here, sweetheart. You want this? Do you want this? Of course you do.
He says it all started on the back deck of his suburban home with one raccoon. His name was Robbie.
I could go out at 6 in the morning and he'd hang around and I'd have my coffee in my hand and I'd yell, Robbie, Robbie. And here he'd come right up the stairs. He wanted some treats and toys and he would play for a little bit and then he was on his way.
The bill is opposed by the Kansas Health Department and the committee hasn't voted on it yet, which could doom its chances this year. Casper says he knows the push to legalize pet raccoons will be an uphill battle.
There's been some naysayers, but I would tell you that overwhelmingly, this is a very popular movement. So it's not going away.
Whatever happens, Casper says, he is not giving up. For NPR News, I'm Rose Conlin in Wichita, Kansas.
This is NPR News.
Avian flu has infected dozens of Americans. Experts say the tools to contain previous bird flu outbreaks just aren't working, and farmers are begging for a new approach.
We are in a battle and losing at the moment.
Battling bird flu, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, we remember the Secret Service agent who rushed to shield the Kennedys when he heard gunfire on November 22nd, 1963.
Before Dallas, you know, I was Clint Hill. After that, I've been known as the man who climbed onto the president's car.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal judge in Seattle has blocked President Trump's effort to suspend the U.S. refugee program. As NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran reports, Trump indefinitely paused the refugee admissions on his first day in office.
In his ruling, U.S. District Judge Jamal Whitehead said Trump has discretion to suspend refugee admissions, but, quote, that authority is not limitless. The lawsuit was filed by the International Refugee Assistance Project on behalf of major aid groups who say their ability to provide services to refugees was hampered by the suspension of the U.S. admissions program. The Trump administration had said the suspension would last until the entry of refugees aligns with the interests of the country. The shutdown left thousands of refugees stranded around the world, despite many having scheduled travel to the U.S. Pending an expected appeal, admissions and funding for refugee groups must resume. Sergio Martinez-Beltran, NPR News.
Well, we could start paying even more for groceries if President Trump's tariffs on foreign goods from Mexico and Canada take effect next month. As NPR's Windsor Johnson reports, this comes after a month-long pause on the threat.
Consumers could start shelling out more for things like Canadian beef, pork products, avocados from Mexico, tequila, maple syrup, and fresh tomatoes. The makers of popular snack brands like Oreos and Slim Jims are also preparing for the possibility of new tariffs. Mexico is a major exporter of fresh produce to the United States, supplying a substantial portion of fruits and vegetables, especially during the winter months. Canada is seen as a major supplier of meat and dairy products. With inflation already driving up prices at the supermarket, consumers might be forced to cut back on spending even more, which could have broader economic ramifications. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. An Alabama grandmother who received a genetically modified pig kidney is doing so well she was able to return home today. NPR's Rob Stein has the story.
Tawana Looney received the genetically modified pig kidney in November and has now survived longer than anyone ever has with a pig organ. Looney will continue to be monitored closely while in Alabama and return to New York City monthly so the doctors who transplanted the pig kidney can check her progress. Doctors hope genetically modified pig organs will help solve the organ shortage. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Inflation and trade war concerns prompted by the Trump administration are taking a toll on both consumer confidence and the future outlook for small businesses. The Conference Board says consumer confidence has slipped to its lowest level in 3.5 years as people are increasingly nervous about stubborn inflation and the threat of tariffs. A monthly survey of small business owners shows they too are concerned about lingering inflation that could worsen under new tariffs on goods from Mexico and Canada. Well, stocks finished mixed on Wall Street today as worries over inflation and White House tariffs on foreign goods continues to impact the markets. The Dow gained 159 points. The tech-heavy Nasdaq, though, lost 260 points, down more than 1.25%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station
And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at DignityMemorial.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The White House said today it will change the makeup of the press pool. That's the small group of journalists who travel with the president and share information with other news organizations. Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said the White House will now determine which outlets are in the pool. Until now, the White House Correspondents Association ran the pool through a rotation of its members. The president of the association wrote that this change, quote, tears at the independence of a free press. That president is Eugene Daniels, who covers the White House for Politico and is an analyst on MSNBC. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
As a disclosure, I was on the board of the White House Correspondents Association when I covered the Obama presidency. Explain why you view the White House decision to exert control over the pool as an attack on the First Amendment.
Because at the end of the day, in free countries like the United States is, leaders don't get to pick the people who cover them day in and day out. The WHCA, our job has been for many, many years, as you know, to not keep people out. We consistently bring new organizations in, new types of media in, outlets that are right down the middle, which is the vast majority of them, but also outlets that are conservative or left-leaning, right? And so this is about making sure from us that the people who have been handling this the entire time, that reporters are making the decisions about who covers the president, and it's not the government of the United States.
Press Secretary Caroline Levitt, in justifying this decision, said, quote, legacy media outlets who've been here for years will still participate in the pool, but new voices are going to be welcomed in as well. Does she have a point that access for these new outlets should not be restricted?
They weren't. We have consistently added in new organizations into our actual press pool, definitely into the association, and helped them to understand what it takes to cover. The reason that some of what she's talking about is these outlets who feel like they haven't been a part of the press pool yet, that is because we have policies and have been created over years to make sure that folks understand how to cover the White House, to help them and their organizations understand the resources it takes to cover the White House. It's not about, like I said, it's not about keeping people out. It's about making sure that the American people have the most, the people who are covering the president of the United States are ready to do that at all times. And that's what the WHCA has done for a long time. And this is bigger than the WHCA. This is about the White House press corps and having the right people covering the president of the United States. And that's independent news organizations that aren't chosen by the president of the United States.
Do you have any recourse besides using your voice?
You know, at this time, we're using our voice and we are working with the news organizations to understand what this means. But the logistics of a press pool are difficult, and trying to create that from scratch is not something that is easy. But what we're doing right now is making clear to the American people what's going on, not because we want to be the opposition at all. We are not the opposition. We simply want to do our jobs as reporters and as the WHCA president. I simply want to make sure that the folks in my organization and all people that come and cover the White House have what they need to be able to do so.
Just briefly, as long as I can remember, the White House Correspondents Association has fought over access and transparency. Do you see this as fundamentally different from those kinds of tug of wars in the past?
It feels more existential. It does feel a little bit different than the past, right? We've talked about, you know, getting one more person into a news conference. This feels a little bit different to us.
Eugene Daniels is president of the White House Correspondents Association. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much.
The largest measles outbreak in decades in Texas is quickly spreading. How bad is it? Well, state officials are reporting 124 confirmed cases, mostly in the western part of the state, and exposure alerts have also been issued in central Texas. Gabriela Alcorta Solorio is a reporter with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio and joins us now. Hi there.
Hi.
So just start, if you can, by telling us where and when this all started.
So the outbreak originated in Gaines County, which is a small county in West Texas next to the New Mexico border. The state released a health alert at the end of January that two school-aged children tested positive for the virus and they were hospitalized. Both of them were unvaccinated. And as of today, we have 124 confirmed cases, five of those being in vaccinated people. And here I should note that Gaines County, where 80 of the cases are, had the highest unvaccinated rate in the state this school year, according to state health data. And this county borders New Mexico, where state officials report 9 confirmed cases.
This is the third measles outbreak across the country this year. That's according to the CDC, and it's the worst. I wonder, are scientists worried about a wider resurgence of measles, which was declared to be eliminated here in the U.S. back in the year 2000?
Yeah, so Dr. Peter Hotez is a professor of pediatrics and molecular virology at Baylor College of Medicine. He expressed concern that this could be just the beginning of a serious outbreak.
These are bad illnesses that generations of scientists worked, labored so hard to make vaccines. And we have an ecosystem that's in place and working, and it's been very successful and well monitored.
The virus is extremely contagious. 90% of people close to someone infected and who are not immune, they will contract the virus. It can live for 2 hours on surfaces, and it can live in the air for 2 hours after an infected person sneezes or coughs.
Wow. Well, tell me, what are health officials there in Texas saying now about risks of measles in other parts of the state?
So on Sunday, state officials released a health alert that an individual who had tested positive stopped at two university campuses and tourist attractions on the San Antonio Riverwalk. Officials sent out alerts immediately asking those who had been anywhere near these locations to monitor for symptoms such as fever or unexplained rashes for up to 21 days. Now, to keep in mind, in a few weeks, the city is hosting the NCAA Men's Final Four, so authorities hope to contain this. Anita Curran is deputy director of the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District, and she says the vaccine is widely available.
It's available in your doctor's offices, in your pharmacies, in your urgent care centers, in community health centers, including public health departments. So if you're looking to get vaccinated, these are some of the places that you should go. Start with the doctor's office if you have one.
Curian did note that anyone who thinks they were exposed should notify any healthcare facility before showing up.
Got it. Okay, last thing here. Who should be thinking about getting revaccinated for the measles?
So children are at higher risk for the virus, according to the CDC. So getting the first dose of the vaccine is recommended around 12 to 15 months, and the second dose is 4 to 6 years. If adults are unsure of their vaccination status, they can contact their primary care provider to get a copy of their records. But the CDC does say those who were born before and after 1957 and before 1968 should consider getting revaccinated due to the fact that during that time, the vaccine was administered with an inactive virus and it proved to be inefficient.
Gabriela Alcorta Solorio is a reporter with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. White House efforts to target what it calls the woke military are impacting longstanding relationships and practices at the Defense Department, including the recruiting of women and people of color. Steve Walsh with WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia, reports.
A year ago, Army Major General Jeth Ray was interviewed at the Black Engineer of the Year Awards conference in Baltimore.
I mean, the opportunity to meet individuals from a diverse background, I think that's just an important piece of what makes us all we can be.
The event has been a staple for military recruiters for decades. This year, all of the services pulled out at the last minute, says Tyrone Taborn, the conference organizer.
They've been here every year. They're huge participants. The U.S. Navy Academy supplied buses to bring in high school kids. They canceled that on Sunday.
Last year, even Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin attended. Taborn worries what will happen next year if government contractors also pull out.
You now have lost the critical recruiting year. The kids come here because the employers are here and the opportunity is here. On a recruiting side, you go to the place where the talent exists.
In his first public meeting with the troops, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth described the new way of thinking.
I think the single dumbest phrase in military history is our diversity is our strength. I think our strength is our unity. Our strength is our shared purpose, regardless of our background.
West Point shut down 12 clubs geared toward black and women engineers, as well as clubs geared toward Native Americans and Hispanic students. The Pentagon ended official celebrations recognizing a range of groups from Black History Month to people with disabilities. Chris Purdy, an Iraq war veteran, founded the Chamberlain Network to mobilize fellow veterans.
Black History Month doesn't mean we're treating white people differently. It just means that we're celebrating the struggles and the sacrifices that service members who were discriminated against because of their race.
He's worried that the military's public perception has been damaged. At the moment, the question is, how much will the military pull back from initiatives highlighting women, people of color, or LGBTQ troops? The Navy and Marines are holding up annual sexual assault prevention and response, or SEPR, training, including training new advocates. A defense official said these changes in terminology required a thorough review and administrative edits to SEPR policy, programs, and training, but their critical work in the mission continues without pause. The courses have their roots in the aftermath of the 1991 Tailhook scandal, when Navy and Marine flyers were accused of assault and harassment at their annual convention. Josh Conley is with Protect Our Defenders.
One thing people could agree upon is, as a baseline, to have training programs in place to try to minimize and address the prevalence of what virtually everyone agreed was a problem.
Conley says advocates worry that it could be the first step to more permanent changes. Allison Jaslow, CEO of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, says the irony is that the new initiatives have the goal of creating unity, but they have made many people feel isolated.
You know, I think it's something that's like built in you as a member of the military. It's like you're not just going to be like super reactive, but like it's fair to be concerned as to whether current leadership has their backs. And that's on a variety of fronts. And that makes me really sad.
She says it's a particular problem in a military where roughly one-third of the troops describe themselves as members of a racial minority, and nearly 20% are women. For NPR News, I'm Steve Walsh.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. If the name Clint Hill doesn't sound familiar, you might know him as the man on the back of the presidential limousine. He was a Secret Service agent, and moments after John F. Kennedy was shot back in 1963, he leaped onto the president's moving car, trying to shield the Kennedys. Clint Hill lived with that memory for decades. He died last week at age 93. On the 60th anniversary of the assassination, he opened up to radio diaries about that day in Dallas.
It was 12 years ago we first saw this picture. Secret Service agent Clint Hill climbing in the back of the presidential limousine that dreadful November day in Dallas to try to push Jacqueline Kennedy back to protect her life. Clint Hill was a Secret
Before Service Dallas, agent. Before Dallas, I was just, you know, I was Clint Hill. After that, I've been known as the man who climbed onto the president's car.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Bob Walker speaking from Dallas Love Field, where a large crowd is...
In November 1963, we arrive in Dallas. As we're going through this crowd, I'm in the follow-up car immediately behind the presidential vehicle.
There's Mrs. Kennedy, and the crowd yells...
I'm on the running board, left-hand side, which puts me closest to Mrs. Kennedy, who is in the left rear of the presidential vehicle.
And here is the President of the United States. And what a crowd, what a tremendous welcome he's getting now.
By the time we got to Main Avenue, the crowd was so large, they could not be contained on the sidewalks. People were hanging out of windows. They were on top of buildings. They were on fire escapes. Any place they could be to see the president and the first lady. We got down to the end of Main, turned right, entering an area called Dealey Plaza. And all of a sudden, I hear this explosive noise over my right shoulder. I didn't think at first it was a gunshot. I thought it was a firecracker or something. But when I saw the president's reaction, I knew that was not normal. I mean, he threw his hands to his throat and started to fall to his left. I jumped off of the car I was on, running as fast as I could run, so I could provide some protection for both President and Mrs. Kennedy. That was what I was trying to do. But as I approached the vehicle, there was a gunshot. The shot hit him somewhere in the lower portion of the head in the rear and exploded out just above the ear, and it was just a mass of blood all over me, all over Mrs. Kennedy. Mrs. Kennedy had come up on the trunk. I got up there and I helped her get back into the back seat. She was in shock. There's no question about that. She was in absolute shock. And I'm up there on the back of the car. So I turned and I gave a thumbs down to the follow-up car crew. Shook my head no, and I hollered at the driver, get us to a hospital. We pulled up at the emergency room. They had five or six doctors at one time working, one on the heart, one on the lungs. They did everything they could. So I asked the nursing staff, get me a phone. I wanted to talk to people at the White House, and the operator cut in. And he said, the Attorney General wants to talk to you. Well, the Attorney General was Robert Kennedy, the president's brother. He said, well, how bad is it? I did not want to tell Robert Kennedy that his older brother, Jack, was dead. So I simply said, it's as bad as it can get. And with that, he hung up.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
The Associated Press in its first report says that President Kennedy was shot just as his motorcade left downtown Dallas. Clint Hill, a Secret Service agent assigned to Mrs. Kennedy, escorted the president into the hospital.
When I was a kid, my father taught me that when you're given a job to do, you do it completely, all the way through, until it's totally done correctly. And I had failed in this case because the president was dead. I then went into an extreme depressed state.
at my home in Virginia. I lived on two packs of cigarettes a day and a bottle of scotch. That's how I slept. I just refused to talk to anybody. Not the agents, not the family, nobody. The only time I ever talked about it was that I talked to the Warren Commission in 1964, and I talked to 60 Minutes in 1975.
Clint Hill was a Secret Service agent for 17 years. He was chief of the White House detail. But Clint retired from the Secret Service 4 months ago at the age of 43. In the first public statement he has made, sitting with
I was really emotional, and much more than I had anticipated.
Was there anything that the Secret Service or that Clint Hill could have done to keep that from happening?
Clint Hill, yes.
Clint Hill, yes? What do you mean?
If he had reacted about 5/10 of a second faster, or maybe a second faster, I wouldn't be here today.
You mean you would have gotten there and you would have taken the shot?
Yes, sir.
And that would have been all right with you?
That would have been fine with me.
You couldn't have gotten there. You surely don't have any sense of guilt about that.
Yes, I certainly do. I have a great deal of guilt about that. Had I turned in a different direction, I'd have made it. It's my fault.
Over the years, a lot of agents have said they're agents now because they saw what I did in 1963. It was heroic. But I don't take any comfort in being considered a hero. That assassination is like a movie. Goes around in my brain all the time. The total elapsed time, they say, from the time of the first shot until the last shot was 6 seconds. That 6 second period in Dallas, it's not an easy thing to live with. It's kind of weird to think that 6 seconds can last for a lifetime.
That was Clint Hill sharing his story on Radio Diaries in 2023. The former Secret Service agent died last week. He was 93 years old.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice. At ajws.org. From USPS, USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. And from EC.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
With that cat there?
Must be full of reefer.
Full of reefer?
Yeah, man.
Mean that cat's high?
Sailing lightly.
Get away from here. Man, is that the reefer, man?
That's the reefer, man.
I believe he's losing his mind.
I think he's lost his mind.